too much coke and too much smoke. Look what's going on inside you.
When it's summer in New York City and hotter than it is today, New Yorkers often find themselves wondering, what is that smell? For today's Please Explain, we'll learn all about odors, pleasant and putrid alike, and how our sense of smell actually works. I'm Julie Burstein, sitting in for Leonard Lope today, and my guests to talk about smell are Dr. Charles Wysocki of the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia and Dr. Luca Turin, Chief Technical Officer of Flexitrol, Inc., and the author of The Secret of Scent, published by Echo in 2006. I'm pleased to welcome them both to the Leonard Lope Show. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello there.
Later on, we're also going to be taking questions from you about the sense of smell at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Dr. Turin, I was listening to that song and thinking about a description that you have in your book about how smell is a sense where the thing itself actually enters into you, that when you smell something, the molecules are in your nose.
Yes, it's remarkably, it took quite a long time for people to understand that. People thought at some point that molecules acted at a distance. But no, when you smell something, you're actually inhaling some small amount, but not negligible. You can make yourself quite ill by smelling, some nasty molecules.
Does everything have a smell, even if we don't immediately notice it?
No. In order for something to have a smell, it has to release molecules, and the molecules have to be small enough to fit into the receptors in our nose that detect them. And so typically, anything larger than about 16 carbon atoms will have no smell at all.
Ah, so it has to be tiny to smell rather than large.
Yes, it has to fit between, it has to have a maximum size of about 16 carbons, beyond which what happens is some people can still smell the molecule and some people can't, and then when you get to about 17 carbons, nobody can.
Now, in the intro, I talked about hot summer days, and I know living in New York City, summertime does seem to be the time of smells. Does heat affect everything in terms of our sense of smell?
Well, heat does two things. First of all, it causes bacteria and every sort of microorganism that lives on garbage to work twice as hard. And the other thing it does is that it causes molecules to leave their perch and fly off towards your nose. As you know, if you put, for example, if you spray perfume on the back of your freezer,
not much
no
would
smell
happen
whatsoever.
Right.
You smell it on your skin, you smell it intensely.
Right. And if you put it in your oven, it would be something entirely
different. Yeah, well, that would cook it.
But Dr. Wysocki, say someone just handed me a freshly baked apple pie. How do my nose and my brain work to recognize what's going on here?
Oh, that's a very complicated issue, but I'll try to explain simply.
Okay.
As Dr. Turin suggested or stated, that those molecules from the pie have to enter the nose. Now, that's a complex mixture of different molecules, and we learn to interpret the complex mixtures by experience. There are probably hundreds of compounds that are being inhaled when you're smelling the pie. They interact with the receptors in the nose. The pattern is then generated, and ultimately, at different parts of the brain, the pattern is interpreted in different ways. It may influence our moods and our emotions. It certainly allows us to make descriptions about what we're smelling because the information is now being processed by the cortex, the convoluted part of the brain where we can process information and talk about what we're experiencing. But there's probably a lot more going on that's at the subconscious level as well.
And is that subconscious piece part of why smell and taste are so linked too?
Smell and taste are very much linked when we put something into our mouth. When we're smelling the pie from the oven, we know it's at a distance. However, once an individual consumes a piece of that pie, we all, most, even the experts, myself included, fall into the trap of calling it a taste when we should know better because it's aroma. It's a combination of taste, which is sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and savory. And then everything else comes from the appreciation of texture and, more importantly, the aroma that is interpreted by the receptors in our nose.
Dr. Turin, why is it then, you know, when I smell a pie, sometimes I think about a friend of mine who baked extraordinary pies, and that scent itself is enough to bring her up in my memory?
There's something really unique about a particular combination of smells, so that particularly in perfumery, if your grandma happened to wear, you know, some perfume which is now extinct, you will simply never encounter it. There's no such thing as sort of second best or close enough. And unless you go to the perfume museum in Paris and actually smell your grandma's perfume, that'll never really fully come back. And I guess the answer to your question is our sense of smell is just really good. And in the same way that we can recognize a voice, you know, among thousands, we can recognize one type of apple pie. So I assume if your friend did it in a particular way, you will recognize that one.
And just that scent of cinnamon can bring that image back to me.
Absolutely.
I love how you say an extinct fragrance. It's almost as if, are these things alive for you?
Well, they are, unfortunately, in some ways, because they seem to evolve with time, generally in the direction of being cheapened and damaged. Because I think every few years, accountants look over the formulae of major fragrances and say, well, wait a minute, what is that thing in there that costs, you know, $4,000 a kilo? Can't we replace it with something else? So, yes, they are alive. I wish they were a bit more sort of permanent than that.
I'm speaking with Dr. Luca Turin and Dr. Charles Wasacki, and we're talking about scent, and we're going to take your calls in a couple of minutes. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692 if you have questions about the mechanism and how we smell, and also about things that you have smelled or would love to smell. Dr. Wasacki, what are the factors that influence, say, my sense of smell versus my mom's sense of smell or someone else's sense of smell? Are these individual?
There are many factors, and yes, they basically amount to individual differences. It starts with the genes that we have. There's variation. Some people have genes that don't make the appropriate receptors, whereas other people do have the receptors being expressed. There are differences between men and women. Women, in general, have a better sense of smell than do men. Aging affects how we smell. It affects the perception of smells at different rates. They decline differently with age. Effects of experience play a major role. An individual who smells roses for the very first time on a walk through the garden with her mother on a very nice, lovely day will, as an adult, have experiences or memories of the smell of roses that will be much different than the child who smells roses for the very first time at the death or the funeral of the mother.
So it's associative in that way.
Yes, it is. Very much so. Context specific.
Now, I had read, and I may be getting this wrong, but years ago I had read something about how the loss of the sense of smell can sometimes be linked to neurological illnesses like Alzheimer's.
That is correct. There is a very gradual loss in the ability to recognize what particular odors are and properly describe them. There are many neurological diseases and conditions that can affect the sense of smell. So if an individual does, in fact, have a loss of smell, a sense of smell, it doesn't mean that that individual is at the first stages of Alzheimer's.
I know. I also wonder about whether the sense of smell can be affected by things like pregnancy. I know when I was pregnant, I couldn't bear the smell of frying onions, even though I love them. And there are all those jokes about women who can't stand smells. Is that true? Does physiologically, does our sense of smell change?
Yes. Women who are experiencing a pregnancy do become more sensitive to many odors, and they're responses to the odors vary very much differently from their experiences and their pleasures before pregnancy.
Dr. Turin, in your experience, do people have different reactions to a particular scent? Could one man's perfume be another's terrible odor?
That's relatively rare. I mean, my experience with pure aroma chemicals, which is to say the ingredients which go into fragrances, and, you know, asking perfumers, suggests that only a minority of components of perfume actually perceived very differently by different people. There are many that are not perceived by some people, and that's why, for example, perfumers tend to put several musk-smelling molecules into a fragrance.
Because they want to make sure that that everybody responds
exactly,
to it.
To cover all the bases. But there's a couple of materials. There's one famous one called Caranal, which is a very intense, it smells like rubbing alcohol, but it lasts a lot longer. And about 9% of people, if my memory serves me, chiefly women, smell that as intensely urinous. So if you're sitting around a table, you will get, you know, two groups of completely different opinions.
Mm.
And that, but that's most unusual. Generally speaking, perfumers agree on the first three words they would use to describe a particular molecule, and then they may diverge on the fourth and fifth.
Oh, that's interesting. So that, like with wine tasting, if people are smelling a particular scent, they might have the same descriptors for it and then diverge.
Yes. And I mean, in a sense, I mean, if you think about it, the very existence of the art of perfumery depends on people generally agreeing what things smell of. And I would say the same actually for cookery, for cooking.
I'm speaking with Dr. Luca Turin and Dr. Charles Wasacki, and we have a number of people on the phone, and we're going to be going to your calls in just a moment after this short break.
I love your smell. I love the scent of you. Suits you so well. The adolescent redolence of you. I love the way when you walk by my sinuses swell. I love your smell. I love your smell. I love your smell.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lope today, and I'm speaking about smell right now with Dr. Luca Turin and Dr. Charles Wysocki. Dr. Wysocki, I'm listening to that song and thinking about the idea of pheromones, which could you describe what pheromones are?
Well, pheromones are ubiquitous, found across all of the animal world, basically. They are compounds that are released by one member of the species and detected by another member, and they typically elicit a behavioral or a physiological response. This is also true in people. There's been a long debate about whether people emit pheromones and other people detect them. There's enough information now that's currently available in the biomedical literature to show that, yes, people do emit chemical signals, and other people can respond to them. The biggest one we hear about are sex attractants. That is the one place where there isn't very good, if any, biomedical evidence for sex attractants, although there are about 1.1 million websites, most of them trying to sell magic bullets, usually to guys who are out looking for a date for the evening.
And Dr. Turin, you write about this also in your book about how pheromones have a connection to why, when a group of women might live together, that their menstrual cycles might be in sync.
Yes, and in fact, I recently read an article suggesting that this supposedly well-established phenomenon was being called into question because some of the statistical analyses were questionable. So I'm not really sure what the status of that piece of information is, but yes, it used to be regarded as one of the classical pieces of evidence for humans emitting pheromones.
Someone told me a story this morning about a mother whose baby was premature, and she wasn't able to spend much time with the baby, and her milk didn't come in. And the doctor said to her, "Well, part of it is you're not close enough for your brain to be picking up the baby's pheromones. That there might be that kind of connection too."
Well, I know that when my daughter was born, she smelled wonderful. She smelled of ambergris. And I asked the doctors not to wash her for several days until they ignored my request and just gave her a clean. But she smelled absolutely sensational, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if that smell were some sort of signal.
To a mom. Well, we have lots of calls here, and let me go to Chris in Brooklyn. Chris, I think you have a question that Dr. Wysocki might want to answer.
Yes, my question is about amnesia or amnesia. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but a lack of sense of smell. I don't have a sense of smell. I have memories from when I was very, very young of smelling, and at some point I lost it. I don't think I had any traumatic injury or anything, and it wasn't until I was older that I sort of realized I didn't have smell when everyone else was complaining about this stinks or this smells great, and I was like, huh?
Well, what you're describing is anosmia. Anosmia can and often does result from an infection, a viral infection, a severe viral infection. People don't usually notice it because they may have a stuffed nose as well. And it's not until usually well after the viral infection has passed do they come to realize it. Or in your case, it could be a very long time after you initially lost a sense of smell. Accidents can also cause nerve damage. Oftentimes, people with anosmia that is trauma-induced will have the sense of smell return. Not always, but it may return many years after the loss. But yes, there are many causes, unfortunately, for people to lose their sense of smell. And it's really unpredictable how those individuals will respond. Some people are indifferent to the loss. Others become very depressed because they can no longer appreciate the smells of garden or of food or beverage or perfumery, for that matter. So it's really difficult to know what to say to people who have lost their sense of smell, except to be aware of the surroundings.
You know, it is interesting. We hear and read a lot about what happens if you lose the sense of sight, say, or hearing. But losing the sense of smell, I have not read that much written about that and what it would be like for someone who loses that sense.
That's correct. In part, that's due to the recency of our understanding of the physiology and the biology of the sense of smell. For a long time, there wasn't anything that really could be done to help anyone. And when they reported to their personal physician that they've lost their sense of taste, which they are really confusing it with the sense of smell.
Mm-hmm. And that may be the first thing that they actually notice rather than smell?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's not really taste. When they're tested, it turns out to be their sense of smell. But now, in the last decade or so, as we have really begun to understand how the sense of smell works and what can be done to help people who have lost their sense of smell, physicians and clinics are now turning more towards treatments and proper diagnosis than basically telling the patient, oh, just live with it. You're fortunate you haven't lost your vision.
I'm speaking with Dr. Charles Wysocki, who is at the Monell Chemical Senses Center and also at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Luca Turin, who is at Flexitrol, Inc., and has written beautifully about scent, and we are talking about the sense of smell and taking your calls at 212-433-WNYC. Gentlemen, we were talking about losing the sense of smell. Our next caller, Mary from Tarrytown, has a question about using the sense of smell to heal us. Mary, what's your question?
My question is, how much credence do you put on aromatherapy?
Dr. Turin, do you have anything to say about that?
I put none.
None, so that these claims that smelling lavender can relax you or smelling, I don't know what else, could invigorate you, you don't think that there's really credence in that?
Well, I mean, if that's all they claim, that's fine by me. I find personally lavender to be pretty invigorating. But beyond that, I don't honestly see how it can work. I mean, there are pharmacology effects of these molecules. If you swallow a spoonful of lavender oil, I'm sure you'll feel it, and you may be able by inhalation to get enough into your body to have some sort of effect. But broadly speaking, the notion that the smell of a substance can directly influence your state of health or your physiology strikes me as innocuous, but unlikely.
How about your state of mind?
You know, I don't think, you know, our state of mind is a slippery thing, and I certainly think that a great fragrance or the smell of a really good roast or a terrific wine can put one in a good mood, but mm-hmm. I think if the secret of happiness was smelling lavender, we would have figured that out.
There would be literature from prehistoric times. That does get me to a question for you, Dr. Torina, which is, what is the first sort of recorded sense of people using artificial scents to enhance whatever it is they were trying to enhance?
Do you mean artificial? Do you mean synthetic, made by chemists?
Or even taking some sort of natural scent that isn't a human scent and using it to either mask their own smells or create something alluring.
As usual, you know, the Egyptians get wheeled out on these occasions. You know, as the first to do just about everything. it's hard to go beyond that. There is evidence. You know, sometimes it's hard to tell what. If you find, for example, in a tomb, some resin, it's hard to know whether the resin was used for, you know, because of its smell or for some other purpose. But generally speaking, I think as far back as recorded history, people have used several, often resins, in fact, incense and myrrh and other, you know, gum mastic resin, for example, for preservation of things and for their pleasant smell. So perfume is very old. The Egyptians did have complex perfume compositions that have come down to us via several, you know, quite detailed recipes. Some of these have been reconstituted, and I am reliably informed that they smell wonderful. Mm. I haven't smelled them myself.
Dr. Wysocki, what about the smells we create ourselves? What causes body odor, for example?
Body odor can have many different sources. It can be just breakdown of metabolites from what we're ingesting. It can be natural scents.
So it's true if you eat garlic, it can come out through your skin?
Yes, it can. That's true of cumin, also other spicy foods. Oftentimes, they find their way through the skin or, for that matter, on the breath hours later. Also, diseases can influence our body odor. Characteristically, there are, for example, acetone breath has long been associated with diabetes.
And so it's used diagnostically by doctors?
Historically, it was. Modern physicians have not received the proper training in the use of the nose. They rely more on laboratory tests and sophisticated equipment.
We have a call from Patrick in Manhattan. Patrick, you have a question for Dr. Wysocki and Dr. Torin.
Hi. Yes, I guess my primary question was, is there a periodic table of smells, in particular ones that delineate exactly why to a human a smell is good or bad? And I was also wondering, which has a better sense of smell, a shark or a bloodhound? And also, I guess I'd warn against buying those mail order pheromones. You can be set for to attract moose or weasel or something. You never know.
As for pleasant and unpleasant smells, it's my impression that there are very few smells that are wired in to be considered unpleasant. Speaking as someone who was brought up in France and gradually grew to like French cheeses, I think there's a fair amount of reprogramming that can go on there. However, it appears that the smells of decay, namely amines, fishy smells, and sulfuraceous smells, you know, rotten egg type smells, those things are probably not considered pleasant at any point in someone's life. And it makes good sense because you wouldn't want to eat anything that was emitting that kind of molecule.
And so it's, in a sense, self-preservation to find those things awful.
Yes, it would make sense. In terms of evolution, I think the guys who were eating the stuff that smelled of amines probably dropped dead.
Didn't have many offspring. Yes,
exactly.
That's probably true.
When it comes to sharks and bloodhounds, I'd love to go hunting with a shark. You know, I imagine their sense of smell is quite extraordinary. But water is diffusion is much slower in water, so they depend on convection. Whereas, I think in air It may be a mixture. It's a good question. I have no answer to that one.
Dr. Waisaki, I know you work with animal sense of smell also. Do you have an idea about the bloodhound shark question?
Each species has its unique environment, and it's probably evolved to make use of the chemical information in that environment. And so since there really hasn't been a comparison between shark and bloodhound, I would just be speculating if I made any comparison there. There has been comparisons between dogs and humans, and for the most part, and these are people placed in the very same apparatus as the dog would be performing its behavior, and the dog outperforms, not surprisingly, the human subjects.
And evolutionarily, was that true, do you think, when we relied more on our sense of smell to be able to, say, find prey or do whatever it is we needed to do with smell? Or do you think that we just have never had as sensitive a sense of smell?
When I say there's a difference between dog and human, that's when it's put to the very supercritical test and the dog is very highly motivated. People mm-hmm. do have, in general, a good sense of smell, even though we denigrate it. However, having said that, if we look at the genes that are expressed for these receptors that are used to detect the different molecules, humans have far fewer functional genes. We're endowed with about 1,000 genes that would normally code for these molecular receptors. However, only about 350 of them are active, whereas in the dog is up close, much closer to 1,000.
That's very interesting.
If I may just add, Richard Feynman used to jokingly say that the reasons why dog had an unfair advantage was that their noses were closer to the ground.
That as we stood upright, we failed to use this sense enough to keep all of those genes. I'm speaking with Dr. Luca Turin and Dr. Charles Waisaki. We're talking about smell. We're taking your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC. I'm going to go now to Diana in Manhattan. Diana, you have a question.
Oh, thank you so much. I have been curious about this for such a long time. I read it somewhere, and I've never been sure that I read what I read. So there's these two professionals. I thought I could get an answer to my question. It's about our senses. And what it is I was read that the sense of smell is the most profound of our senses because as we inhale, it goes directly to our brain. There's no interference, whereas with the rest of our senses, they have to be processed through other parts of the body and end up in our brain. And I was curious if that is true or not.
Sorry, I don't mean to butt in, but I think there's a confusion here between there is what you're saying is to some extent true in the sense that the pathway between the front end neurons and the brain is different for smell than it is for, say, vision, insofar as the olfactory tract connects to a different part of the midbrain and does not go through several of the way stations that, for example, vision goes through. So it is in some purely wiring sense a more direct connection. What that means in terms of how we process the information is unclear because, as Dr. Waisaki pointed out, in the end it ends up in this extraordinary computer, you know, which we call the cortex. And so whether one more way station makes a big difference is not clear.
I'll just add to that. It may be because we have a major highway going directly to the regions of the brain from the nose, the parts of the brain that analyze moods and emotions or modify moods and emotions. And perhaps it's this reason why memories that are evoked by odors are so much more evocative and emotive than memories evoked by auditory or visual cues.
That's interesting. So that the connection between smell and our kind of getting a mood or an emotion is a much more direct one than, say, sight or hearing.
On a strictly anatomical basis, yes.
Has there been research then into things like autism, I know that there's a lot about an inability to read somebody else's mood. Does smell play a part in that too? Has that been researched?
Yes, I was actually invited to a working group of a foundation that works on autism to review some of the evidence in the field, and there appears to be a remarkable connection between smell and autism, in the sense that several people have claimed with some, you know, good degree of credibility that exposing autistic children to a variety of smells markedly improves their engagement with the world.
Hmm.
And in fact, Dr. Galaburda from Harvard has built a very interesting hypothesis around the fact that the structures that may be dysfunctional in autistic children in the medial forebrain are actually close or even overlapping with some of the ones that are involved in smell.
That's fascinating. In this world now, where we can still, thank goodness, smell a rose, but often our noses are filled with the smells of the laundry detergent that someone has decided should smell like something, or the smell of a bakery that's sending out its scent. Are we living in a kind of very confusing scent landscape now, more confusing, say, than people 100 years ago?
Well, I think that it's a lot cleaner now than it was 100 years ago.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that piece of it. So that we're not smelling the smells of decay as much as we did if we were in New York, say, in 1907 rather than 2007.
That's correct. There's a fascinating book by David Susskind called Perfume that describes what it was like a few centuries ago in France. And it's a very, very excellent description of what environments could be like.
I think my personal experience is that exactly as Dr. Masaki said, that things are less smelly now than 30, 40 years ago. General hygiene is better. The streets are clean more often. And for that matter, people wear, for the most part, quieter perfumes. I'm always struck by how it's hard to tell these days by walking down the street what perfume is fashionable, whereas 20 years ago you could tell instantly. However, fragranced products are everywhere. These days, almost everything you buy has a fragrance composition in it. And that is partly because, you know, if you think about it, all soap powders are pretty good at cleaning. And so ultimately what differentiates one from the other has to be the fragrance.
We have about 15, 20 seconds left. What can we do to enhance our sense of smell? Is there anything that one can do for that?
Cook.
I like to say use it or lose it.
Because as I hear both of you, I think about how as a parent you're told to expose your children to lots of words and wonder if that's true about smells as well.
Yes, I think food will do it, in my opinion.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Dr. Luca Turin, who is the author of The Secret of Scent and the forthcoming Perfumes, The Guide, and Dr. Charles Wysocki, who is a member of the Monell Chemical Senses Center. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining me today on The Leonard Lopate Show.
My pleasure.